Welcome to The Mindful Leader, the podcast where we seek to understand the mental health, mental state, and well-being of leaders and how they can take control of them so that other leaders, perhaps like yourself, can become more productive, more fulfilled, and better leaders yourself. My name is Seven Jacobs, and in today's episode, we'll be listening to a woman named Andrea. Now, today's episode is a bit of a first for us because often we don't talk just about one specific mental health issue or type of experience. We'll cover certain experiences that our guests have that they can help us use to understand various different perspectives around what we can do for ourselves and for our own mental health. But what comes out of today's episode is a bit more of a focus on specific issues that she helps all of the people that she works with, including leaders, overcome. Now, I'm going to insert a trigger warning here for suicide and suicidal thoughts and ideation. And that's because today's episode with Andrea focuses on her experiences as well as the kinds of things she supports others with, one of which is around suicide awareness and working with people who suffer from those kinds of experiences. As someone myself who grew up with all kinds of different issues that led to this feeling of I am not good enough and I never will be as I got older, which in many ways became reinforced as I became a young leader myself because of the kinds of positions I was put into and put myself into and narratives I started to tell myself as a result. It's an episode that's very important to me, but I think it's one that is pretty much never talked about in this kind of space, right? Because I think a lot of the times when we think leader, we think the CEO. But imagine a CEO telling you about their suicidal thoughts, if they have them, right? That'd be like, oh my God, that's crazy. The thought of that is almost crazy because leaders need to be in this position of strength or perceived strength. So as a result, in today's episode, we're very keen to hit the nail on the head and be very blunt and be very honest and be very open about these words, these issues, and the experiences that leaders will face as a result of them. We also, therefore, talk a little bit about something called sharpening the saw, which you'll hear a lot more about, but essentially means how do you take time out to take care of yourself. We talk about vulnerability and being honest, and what kind of impact does that have? And we talk about mental energy, right? What happens when our energy is so depleted that we get overwhelmed? And what tends to push us towards things like suicidal thoughts, suicidal ideation, and eventually the kinds of things that there are lots of stats about now, about how it's gotten so much worse, how that kind of issue comes about and how it's gotten so much worse. And as a really important kind of point to round it all off, what we do is we talk about how you can have the kinds of conversations you need to have with yourself, as well as with others within this area to avoid anyone going too far. I hope that makes sense. It does make it a bit of a heavier episode. However, we've also got lots of practical takeaways and points. And of course, if at any point in today's episode you feel the need to speak to someone or like this is really triggering for you in any way, please, please, please take time away from it and seek any help that you need to seek. So with that out of the way, that little preface, please, please, please get stuck into this episode. I hope you enjoy it. It's a heavy one. It's a unique one. It's a first for this podcast, but it's something that leaders need to engage with. So without further ado, let's get into it. Welcome, everyone. Thank you for tuning in once again. My name is Seven, and today I am joined by Andrea. Today's episode is definitely a first for us because it covers something that I've had lots of conversations with leaders about, which is suicide and suicide awareness and prevention. And just a little bit of a kind of warning for this episode. If anything you hear today makes you feel kind of like you need to speak to someone, please do reach out for more support. But I'll have more of that in the kind of description down below. Andrea, thank you so much for joining us today. How are you?
You're very welcome. I'm very well, thank you. Very well.
Good, good. Let's jump straight into it then. Tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Okay, so I've been working in the corporate world for about 26 years now, supporting managers and leaders and helping them be the very best version of themselves. And I tend to work around the area of confident conversations and recognizing that leaders really need to be able to have 7 quite significant conversations if they're going to be effective in that role.
7 significant conversations. What are those 7 conversations?
It basically starts from as soon as you put yourself into a leadership position, are you able to have confident conversations in order to make things happen in the way that you want them to? But can you do that in a way that's respectful to the people around you? So it's about achieving outcomes, but balancing that with maintaining a positive relationship. And conversations that go across a wide spectrum, from challenging conversations, from coaching conversations, all the way through to conversations in crisis, which is where we're going to sort of focus a little bit more today.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. And before we jump into some of my main questions for you, because we've had a conversation before this and I've got a lot of different things I'd love to discuss, but I'd love to learn a little bit more about you in this way. What got you into teaching leaders to have those conversations? What sparked you to go, this is something that we are missing, and this is something that organizations, individuals, leaders, managers, this is something that we need?
I think from the work I've done within organizations, often when I get there, I find that if they're dealing with issues or conflict, often at the root of it was because somebody didn't have the courage to have the conversation that they should have had at that time. And so back in the day, a lot of my work was about really encouraging those courageous conversations so that people say what needs to be said, but again, in a way that's respectful. But my direction changed a little bit when I had my own experiences of, shall we say, rooting around at rock bottom, peering over the edge. And I realized that I personally was avoiding one of the most significant conversations that I ever really ought to have. And so coming back from that, I sort of took a look at my business model and realized that I was in a strong position to be able to make a really powerful difference for leaders. And so the spectrum of significant conversations developed a little from, I guess, from my own lived experience of having failed miserably in that area.
As it often does, though, right? We are our best critics because, well, I say best, we're often our harshest critics, I should say, not always our best critics, because we're very biased against ourselves, hilariously. That's a slightly different conversation, though.
But they do say that we teach what we most need to learn.
I love that. Interesting.
So there's definitely something in that. I ended up in a situation where I intended to take my own life. And when I peel away the layers, I realize it was because I had avoided a very difficult conversation for a number of years. And so, you know, sometimes you have to take a dose of your own medicine, don't you?
That's something I really relate to, because I think I spent a lot of my younger years experiencing things that I couldn't process. And then when my older body, when I became a teenager and then into an adult, right, my older, more developed brain hadn't processed all these things. There were just all these floating thoughts around. And when they've got nowhere to go, you sort of search desperately for somewhere to put them. And if you can, it feels a little bit like you're exploding. Everything is rebelling against you internally. And it becomes this very scary and very lonely kind of place. And sometimes that means we're pushed to this edge. I guess what I'm really interested to know from your experiences with leaders specifically, what tends to push us towards that edge? What does that, I'm in this space where I haven't had these conversations, what does that tend to manifest as, or what kind of conversations does that tend to include that needs to happen? What are those thoughts that push us towards that edge?
I think typically it's a combination of factors. And I think sometimes it's a feeling of complete overwhelm. And I often refer to it as, you know, sometimes people look at what it is that's caused the system to jam, if you like. And it may not be a log that's caused the jam. It could be a buildup of lots of little splinters that together, you know, really impact on our ability to think clearly and analytically and you know, to think rationally. And as you said, sometimes we then turn in on ourselves and, you know, we might blame ourselves for not being good enough, not being able to cope, not being able to do this better. And so it becomes a bit of a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. We start to talk ourselves out of you know, any kind of positive place and start to feel a bit hopeless, even worthless. And I also think that in a lot of ways, leaders are inclined to put on a brave face and don't want to be seen as not capable, not coping, not strong enough, you know, don't want to be seen as vulnerable, because they have this idea that in order to be a leader, you know, you've got to be armored up and, you know, do that whole alpha thing. So I think there's lots of factors that do contribute, dependent on the person and their personal situation.
Yeah, I think that's great what's come out of that, because what people tend to, or I should say, when someone asks me a question of what causes this, I tend to ask, well, what's the context? Because someone's context can radically shift what those different factors that are at play actually mean, or how much they're weighing on you. I think the common things for leaders are exactly what you've brought up. There's overwhelm, and there's also this feeling of loneliness that comes from what you described of kind of needing to be this pillar of strength, right? This I'm standing in front of everyone else facing the world and no one 100% understands me. So I feel really kind of alone as a result. Sometimes that happens because we've isolated ourselves, but nonetheless, it doesn't impact how we feel in those moments.
No, and as you say, you know, that can manifest itself quite differently in different people. I've seen leaders in that situation, rather than allow their vulnerability to be seen, they almost turn into bullies, because that way they keep people at arm's length and nobody gets close enough to realize that actually their leadership style, their bullying behavior almost, is a bit of a way of kind of protecting themselves and keeping people at a distance. So I think it kind of shows up in lots of different ways for different people, dependent on their character, their personality, and their level of confidence, being courageous enough to say, actually, I'm struggling.
100%. And I think that's actually a really interesting example, because something that we've discussed before is that leaders don't want to have conversations that make them feel weak. And so I think, and what you've just described is a very, I think, very common way, really, of showing that you're not weak while making sure no one gets close enough, like you said, to see that you're feeling weak, right? To keep people at arm's length.
Yep.
So I guess a question for you is, how do we have conversations without feeling weak, or these kinds of conversations, I should say, without feeling weak?
I think the first thing is about recognizing, and, you know, it's a trite saying now, but I think it's still true. It's okay to not be okay. And I think, you know, there's a lot of stuff that we need to be doing that helps people realize that sometimes feeling overwhelmed, it isn't about being weak or strong. It's not about being, you know, male or female or alpha or otherwise. It's a complex combination of all sorts of different factors that, you know, can lead us to that place. And the first point is about really recognizing that sometimes, you know, actually to be vulnerable is a huge strength.
Oh, yeah.
Rather than, you know, people seeing that as the weakness, to actually say, this is me, this is where I am, I'm struggling a little bit. The respect that I've seen people gain by just being honest.
Yeah.
And, you know, by letting people know. And actually, sometimes as a leader, if you are not showing that vulnerability, you know, if you're showing up as having all your squirrels in a row and being super sorted, people around you are not going to open up to you. Because you know what? If I've got stuff going on, am I really going to come to you? Because you look like you've got it all perfect.
Yeah. That's a really interesting point. There's a couple of things there that fascinate me, I think would be really interesting to explore a little bit. Number one, what you've just said around people almost being afraid of something that's perfect. It's like you're not, it's not relatable. It's not, I can't empathize with you. And that's the thing about modern leadership is if your CEO, for example, isn't relatable whatsoever,
sure,
it's going to be really hard to identify with the business itself because that leader tends to represent that business. And so if I'm thinking about myself as someone who works for leaders, as well as just being a leader, how can I feel connected to you and therefore to your organization? And that starts to have impacts along the lines of everything within your organization and brings me to a really interesting point around diminishing returns, right? And you brought this up to me the other day when we spoke. It was like what we do when we're doing these things that we've described so far, you know, keeping people at arm's length, putting in extra effort when really what we need is to not do that because we're already overwhelmed. These issues layer and layer and layer, they pile on top of each other. And obviously it's going to hit the point where one of those layers breaks the camel's back, so to speak, right? It's going to happen.
Well, people go into overdrive as well for different reasons. I know my own situation. I did more and more and more and more and more in order to avoid the reality of what my home life was like. And, you know, I got involved in all sorts of projects. I set up a charity. I just did so much because that meant that I didn't have to face facts. I didn't have to face into the reality of my home life. And it also meant that practically I didn't have to go home very often. So, you know, so sometimes people will do it as a way of avoiding or, you know, staying away from whatever the real issue is. But also there's a sense there that if you are starting to feel not good enough, that actually by doing more and more, it may be that what you're looking for that to do is to give you that feeling of self-worth that you're not perhaps getting somewhere else in your life. Yeah. And it may just be simply that we believe that because we're not good enough, we have to do more.
Yeah.
And that is exactly, you know, what I was talking to you about with the whole diminishing returns, the fantastic Coveyism of taking time out to sharpen the saw, you know.
Talk to me about that, about sharpening the saw, because that's something I absolutely love. I love Stephen Covey and read a couple of his books and even his son's book. Talk to us about that, because sharpening the saw is a saying that I think people actually know about in other words, if that makes sense. Like we've heard about that kind of thing, but it's also always the most overlooked, I feel like. So what does that mean to you?
To me, what it is, I mean, the story of the woodcutter who was given outcomes, results, volumes that he needed to produce and realized that actually in order to keep meeting his targets, he felt that he just had to keep doing more and more and more. And in order to do more and more, stopped taking any breaks, didn't, worked longer days, put in more hours, had to persevere with a somewhat blunt saw because he hadn't got time to stop to sharpen the saw. And to me, in sort of today's leadership world, it's about recognizing that if we're not deliberately building in time to disconnect, to detox from digital devices, to relax, to recuperate, to even sleep. I mean, sleep is so important to every system in the human body. And interestingly, we are the only animal that deliberately deprives deprives itself of sleep. So it's, you know, it's about recognizing that sharpening the saw may well be actually stepping back, taking time away, not continuously leading in. Because as you mentioned there, that phrase, the law of diminishing returns, the harder I work, the less I seem to achieve.
Yeah. And what fascinates me the most is why we do this, right? Coming back to what you said a minute ago around leaders essentially feeling inadequate and therefore needing or feeling like they need, there's a part of them that needs to do more and more and more to make up for it. Some of the research that I've seen and read and discussed with even other guests on this podcast now shows us that a lot of leaders get into those positions because they want to do more, right? I'm a leader because I'm able to handle it, but I can handle it because I've pushed myself so incredibly hard. And often actually I haven't put myself in a strong enough position to be great at the things that I'm love and that I'm great at. And I'm there for just because I've pushed myself super hard. And so it can be hard to say, do less. You know?
Yeah, but there's also the other side to that, that sometimes people, especially within organizations, promoted into leadership positions because they were good at what they did.
Yeah.
Not necessarily because they've got the attributes, skills, qualities for great leadership.
Very true.
And, you know, so in some ways, it's almost compensating for the fact that that bit is missing. And actually, you've been promoted, you've been successful because you worked hard, you showed up regularly, you did the job that you're asked to do. So clearly, if you just do that a bit more and a bit harder, that'll be enough.
Yeah, but it's not. It never is, because we reach what's, I forget the exact word, the exact phrase, but it's essentially, we reach this like T junction, right? It's called this like T model, where if you imagine an uppercase T, you're growing, you're going up, and then you hit a management or leadership position that you weren't trained for, and you only went up and up and up because you were good at that one specific job, like you just described. Suddenly you have all these different responsibilities that it spreads out like the top of an uppercase T, but you stop growing at that point because you have all these things you weren't prepared for. And that's why sharpening the saw, I think, is so interesting to me, because especially nowadays, we kind of put a lot of us end up putting ourselves in leadership positions, whether it's something like me taking on a side hustle, starting a charity of my own, like you mentioned, right? It could be all sorts of things. It could just be, you know, volunteering every weekend, something really simple, but we choose to take more of a lead on something. We are putting ourselves within this T where we know we're good at something, and then we haven't taken the time to sharpen that saw to help us with what we really need to help ourselves with so that we can actually do that thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And we see it whether it's within organizations or whether it's in entrepreneurial situations where, you know, your typical entrepreneur who is fantastic at whatever the thing is, whatever the it is, but actually running a business around that and managing people around that, you know, isn't in their skill set.
No.
So the whole sharpening the saw is really taking a step back and being honest and being self-aware and understanding that to get ahead, sometimes we need to invest a little in, you know, time away from it and really developing ourselves so that we can, as you said, take on the additional responsibility and stress and strain that goes with it.
Yeah, 100%. And to bring that back, I suppose, to the question around leaders' mental health, what does that look like and why? Well, I suppose part of the picture that we're painting at the moment is what it can look like is very difficult to manage because there are so many different pieces at play. So the question for me then becomes, what can we do to sharpen that saw? And you've given us a couple examples. For example, we can detach a little bit from our devices for a little while, which I think is one that we say a lot but don't appreciate how powerful it is, if that kind of makes sense. And, you know?
Yeah, we also say it but don't necessarily do it.
Don't do it. Yeah, exactly. And there's a couple other things that for me are really important. So for example, for about a year, year and a half now, I've been taking up regular kind of meditation every morning. Sometimes when that becomes a habit, though, you then need to kind of top yourself up a little bit with, for example, I need to take a whole weekend out just to turn my devices off, a whole weekend out to read certain books, to set new routines for myself. What kinds of things do you see working for the leaders that you have worked with?
I really think it's about everybody finding what works best for them. And, you know, I work with a lot of industries like engineering, construction, manufacturing. And, you know, a lot of guys that I meet ain't going to do the meditation, the mindfulness. And so I always say to people, you know, self-care doesn't have to be candles and sandals. You know, it will be different for different people. And it's about finding what works for you. And that might be a simple as, do you know what? When did you last lie back and listen to some music? Really listen to music, as opposed to having music on in the background while you did 26 other things at the same time. It might be going out over the park with kids and just kicking a football about until your belly laughs. It's different for different people. And the thing is, with self-care in that regard, there's so many different things that we could choose to do, but we need to make that choice. And it's making the choice. You know, it's like the our 5-a-day fruit and veg that we know we're supposed to have for our physical wellness. We know we're supposed to do it, but actually I'm tired. It's been a long day, so I'm going to choose a kebab. So it's kind of making those choices. And self-care is also about recognizing it as a priority. A lot of people will say that self-care is selfish. And if you're a leader, if you're a parent, if you're a charity trustee, if you're a volunteer with your local community, you'll sometimes find that you are a long way down your list of priorities because it feels selfish to take time out for you. And, you know, I always say to the people that I work with, you can't pour from an empty bottle. And if you're not topping up your own tank, how can you possibly be the very best version of you when it comes to leadership, when it comes to being a parent, when it comes to being a community leader, you know? So there has to be an investment in self, but that will be different for every single one of us.
I think inevitably with this podcast in particular, a lot of our listeners tend to be younger leaders. And that means, and therefore it's also tend to be entrepreneurs, therefore, and we can get into this habit of this is the correct way of doing things for people. And those kinds of blanket statements end up being really harmful because everyone is a little bit different. And in fact, what came out of what you just told me was the things that bring you back, regardless of what they are, they tend to bring you back down to earth in a way, right? They tend to connect you with the things that are most important. People, your senses, your ability to have fun and experience joy, regardless of what you find does that for you. That is in a way one of your most important tasks as a leader. Because, as you said, I love this saying, you can't pour from an empty bottle, right? You can't pour from an empty anything, because what you're doing as a leader is you're giving of yourself. You're giving of yourself to your teams, to your business, to your project, your children, whatever it is.
And if you've nothing in there, you've nothing to give. You know, I get people to sometimes think a bit like a bank account, that if you don't make deliberate investments when you can, there won't be anything there to fall back on when the rainy days hit. Actually investing in your own well-being, really thinking about your own self-care, thinking about your own mental health, your mental wellness, your mental fitness. You know, if you want to be resilient, to be able to cope with the more challenging times, you've got to be investing up front like that bank account.
100%. And this is the thing, to me, this is almost a little bit revitalizing to hear you say those kinds of things, because there's a lot on, I use social media as an example, because I do actually think it's the worst at creating this kind of mindset where you know, you need to be throwing 110% of yourself at something all of the time. There's also the school of thought that anything that doesn't make you feel great or that drains you should be avoided completely for the sake of this kind of idea of self-care. And what I always find is that a balance is by far the most important thing, because you will need to do things that drain you. But
for sure,
do you fill that bottle back up before it gets so empty that you're just burning yourself out?
Yeah. And actually, you know, given that there are things that we all have to do that we might not necessarily enjoy and that, you know, don't make us feel great, how can you find a way of doing that so actually it does feel okay? I mean, you know, for me, I am not good at numbers. I hate the whole accounts, VAT return, you know, all of that.
Yeah, me too.
So, but it's a necessary evil. Yeah. You know, if you're going to run a business and it's a successful business, then all right, maybe you delegate, maybe you get to the stage where you can afford to pay somebody to do that for you. But all the time you've got to do it yourself, find a way so that it isn't draining. Mm. You know, put on your favorite piece of music that gives you just that boost, that mindset, and, you know, just kind of see it in a way of, all right, so how can I make the best of something that I do have to do? And then perhaps I can reward myself once it's done with something that I know absolutely gives me joy.
I love that. I love that so much, because here's the thing that I noticed about when we very strongly dislike something is we attach so much of ourselves to it that it becomes this massive, massive undertaking. And what it does to kind of bring it back a little bit to the mental health side of things is it becomes very mentally draining, and in a way that's just a kind of another way of saying of looking at this whole kind of pouring from an empty bottle metaphor. But when we do things that take our mental energy, not just our physical energy, because I've had to, I don't know, be at the office for 10 hours or whatever, but my mental energy, because those things have given me anxiety, lots of anxiety, or they've demanded a lot from my mental processing, we become a little bit stuck in this habit of going, this is just something I need to do. This is just something I need to do.
Oh my God, I lived 10 years of my life telling myself that I just needed to do this.
Right.
I just needed to get through. And, you know, that was exactly the wrong thing for me to be doing, because, you know, to all intents and purposes, I was falling apart inside.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Sometimes we've just got to be even honest with ourselves. You know, we mentioned earlier about how sometimes we can find it difficult to be honest with other people about how we're feeling. Sometimes we're also, you know, we struggle to actually acknowledge and be honest with ourselves that I'm not doing well, you know?
100%. I think in a way, it's another one of these coping mechanisms that we've described, right? If you're able to convince yourself, I suppose, that it isn't true, you will start to believe that it isn't true. And it's just a way of running away from that
truth.
But of course, you'll still be experiencing that. And that means you'll still be, you know, forced to feel overwhelmed. And you'll still be, you'll still be mentally drained and won't be being the effective leader that you want to be. And I think for me, what it comes back to is this kind of idea, which we've talked about on this podcast a little bit before, is say you're, you know, think about, fast forward, imagine what you're going to be doing and thinking on your deathbed, right? If you're 90 years old, you're 100 years old. What kinds of things do we think and feel? What kinds of things do we regret? And we never regret that we didn't work hard enough. We never regret that we didn't work hard enough. But I think it'd be very, very understandable for someone to regret if they had worked too hard to the point of spending a lot of their life not feeling whatever they wanted to feel, joyous, free, connected with other people.
Yeah.
And so it, for me, it comes back to when we're trying to understand what leaders should do next, because it's not like the stresses or problems of the everyday just go away as soon as you think about that. But maybe it's a little bit about, well, how much am I really in control of? And the answer tends to be more than we think we are. For me, it's important to come back to what are these little things that we can do that make it so that we are allowing ourselves to experience more of this joy in the day to day, so that we don't, we're not just overwhelming ourselves all the time, right? We're not doing that kind of, I just need to do the next thing and I just need to do this. We're not telling ourselves those narratives, and instead doing, living, I should say, doing less and living more. Maybe that's the way of looking at it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, the other thing that struck me when you were talking then was, you know, you said about admitting to ourselves, because we don't want to admit to ourselves that we're not coping. But there's also, we know that other people also have expectations of us. For me, as a kind of gobby northern bird with bright orange hair, people would always look at me as being confident and capable, and that was their expectation of me. And so sometimes it's hard to perhaps own up and be seen as something other than what people expect. You know, I grew up in a family where we were taught that you always armor up. You never let people know if they've hurt you. You put a brave face on it. You don't cry because that doesn't fix anything. And, you know, so there was a massive expectation that that's what it needed to look like. And so when I got to the point where I was feeling overwhelmed, it was almost impossible to be able to say, actually, this is what's going on for me, because there was my expectation of me. There was what I believed the world's expectation of me, and also my family's expectation.
And those kind of expectations in our upbringing tend to be the ones that we take with us for, well, I was going to say forever, you get what I mean, for the rest of our lives. A lot of leaders, again, you know, thinking about what pushes someone to become a leader, because it is a difficult thing to do and to become. Sometimes it's those environments that push us to become a leader. Then when we get there, we've still got these habits that we don't even realize we have, or these barriers or these strengths and weaknesses that lead us down these certain paths. What's really interesting for me that I'd love to explore next is a little bit about how this relates back to everything we've talked about, yes, around mental health, but more specifically around stress and inevitably suicide, right? It's something I think I'm really interested to explore in today's episode, because it isn't something we've covered on the podcast before, but I know from the stats, just the stats that are coming out now, a lot more people are either admitting to feeling that way and to be pushed towards that, or are, as a result of the way that life is now, feeling it when they didn't feel that way before.
Yeah, and you know, the stats as they present themselves at the moment suggest that as many as one in five people will have thoughts of suicide. And that has been significantly impacted, obviously, by the last 12 months of the COVID pandemic, where people have not had that connection, that control, that certainty that the human brain craves. And so, you know, suicide typically isn't the result of a one-off event. It's generally a combination, a complex interplay of factors, be it a person's biology, psychology, past life, current life. And we know that at the moment, lots of people are wobbling for all sorts of reasons. But, you know, one of the myths that I think it's important that we do bust, Seven, is that actually suicide isn't always as a result of mental illness. You know, the majority of deaths by suicide are actually people who were simply overwhelmed by life. You know, people who may be struggling with difficult relationships or financial issues or, you know, redundancy. You know, there's a whole host of factors that can contribute towards suicide ideation. It, you know, not everyone who's mentally ill has thoughts of suicide, and not everybody who dies by suicide is mentally ill. And as a society, we need to realise that. We need to understand more about that, you know, and appreciate that if somebody is having thoughts of suicide, the best answer isn't always a visit with the GP and a prescription, you know?
Yeah, 100%. Something you said there really struck a chord, because I have never really been that comfortable with this idea of mental illness, because I think it's so stigmatized and so not defined, or at least feel up, it definitely has a definition but feels undefined for the average person who doesn't know much about it. And so I kind of try to avoid this idea of, is someone mentally ill, because really someone either needs help or doesn't. And regardless of what it is that you need help with, you need that support. I don't think the label of mentally ill is something we need to look at all to even to say, do you need support or not? And that's why what you've just said, you know, really, really hits me, because this is something that's so important to me anyway, that our listeners and just leaders in general can understand, is that regardless of how you see yourself, the image of yourself, your health, if something has stressed you out enough, overwhelmed you enough, pushed you towards this, and you're right, it does often happen over time. And sometimes that means it creeps up on us as well. So it'll just suddenly happen. We'll be like, where did these thoughts come from? Well, we don't usually think that right away. No. But when, you know, we get a chance to, we might think, well, where did this suddenly come from? It's because we are pushed there and it just happens. And regardless of why it happens, we deserve to have the kinds of conversations that you've described.
Yeah. And, you know, there isn't one set route. There isn't a blueprint for somebody having, you know, suicide ideation. It can happen for all sorts of different reasons. And, you know, as I say, we know things like biology, psychology, past life experiences. We know all of that, you know, potentially can contribute. And it often is the combination of those factors. But again, you see, suicide, it's shrouded in silence. We don't want to talk about it. We don't even say the word, you know. So many euphemisms that people will have, you know, they'll say things like, you're not going to do anything silly. Silly. Taking your life is silly. Oh, my days.
It's a lot more
you know?
Than silly.
Silly. Yeah. That's silly is actually not buying those shoes in every color. That's silly. You know, suicide is not about being silly. Or, you know, they'll say something like, you know, you're not going to hurt yourself. Well, no, actually, what I've got in mind doesn't hurt. You know, we just need to get over ourselves and actually think about the language we use and recognize it's just another human condition. Yeah. It happens, you know?
It's ironic the way that we will even glorify in some ways things like murder and certain types of crime, and then as soon as it's suicide, we want to be all hush hush about it. And I can't help but wonder if it's because there's this almost this unspoken shared pain by how absolutely sad it is when we lose someone as a result of that. I feel like there's almost this underlying, even people who struggle with empathy will feel this kind of underlying empathy towards this type of issue, because it is so it's so against any living creature's nature to have those kinds of thoughts. So it's very scary to us. Yeah. And that's something that I think helps in terms of raising awareness about how we can support others in a way, is we tend to find ourselves in situations, I think, where we don't want someone else's experience to reveal to us what our experience is going to be. Let's say, for example, I read this one story where a story was being told by a woman who had a terminal illness. I think it was some type of very rare cancer, and she knew she was going to die eventually. And she was writing about and talking about how people would say all kinds of weird and wonderful things and have all sorts of comments that were just so almost comedically unhelpful. Things like, well, are you sure this doesn't run in your family? As if she wouldn't know if that ran in her family, right? And what when you look at stuff like that, what it tends to come down to is the person asking that is almost trying to defend themselves against the possibility that it could happen to them.
Yeah. And, you know, it's one of those things that maybe if we don't talk about it, it doesn't exist in our world. And all the time that we don't talk about it and we contribute to the stigma, the silence, we're actually contributing to people not being able to ask for the help that they need.
We choose what we wish to be true and label that as reality.
Yeah.
That's one of my favorite kind of sayings, because it's in a way it speaks both to how powerful human beings are as well as to how ridiculous we are and how we cause so many problems. Before we finish up, what I'd like to do is taking some of the stuff we've just talked about and applying it to the idea of helping someone who's in crisis, right? And you talk a bit about being in crisis and what does that look like? And I think those are one of those seven conversations, right, that you say we need to be able to have, which I completely agree with. I think I'd like to look at it from two angles. Number one, if you're going through crisis yourself, how do you have the right conversation with yourself? And then, of course, as a leader, how do you have that conversation with someone else if you notice someone else is in crisis?
Okay, so I think of those two, the more difficult one is actually having the conversation with yourself and being bold enough to admit that things are becoming too much. And I think that's where we need to really draw on our you know, sort of skills, our ability, and face facts. You know, I talk to leaders often about having a mirror moment, you know, being really clear about what's happening for them and you know, sort of being really honest about that. And so I think, first of all, by acknowledging that we are struggling and being prepared to go get the help that we need. Bearing in mind that help doesn't necessarily mean, you know, psychiatric or emotional or psychological help. It may well be that we're simply overwhelmed because we've got so much that we're trying to juggle, so many plates that we're trying to spin, so many things that just seem out of our control that, you know, it's a bit like, how do you eat the elephant? Step back, you know, look at things bit by bit, get some perspective. Because, you know, certainly what I discovered was that all the time stuff's just going round and round in your head, you end up blowing it out of proportion. And I think we've all been there. You know, it might be something really basic, like, I don't know, you need two new tires on your car, but you don't get paid till the end of next month. And so you start to panic thinking, well, what if I get pulled over in the meantime? And am I going to get in trouble? And da, da, da. And because it just keeps going round in your head, you know, the feelings can become very, very intense.
Yeah, it's classic anxiety, isn't it? Where one worry becomes another and becomes another, and the thoughts never go anywhere.
And then it, you know, it gets on that feedback loop. And so your body joins in and says, oh, my days, we're really struggling here. We need to shut down. We need to curl up. And so, you know, I do think it's about looking yourself in the mirror and recognizing that you're not where you need to be. And actually, you know, how can you now get the help that you need? And being bold enough to do that. It's not about being weak. It's not about, you know, not being capable. It's about recognizing that as a human being in a world that's very fast-paced, future-focused, results-oriented, you know, sometimes stuff does get a bit too much. And we just need to take a step back, do some sharpening of the saw, learning techniques, learning strategies that we can use that help keep us on the safe side of the line.
I love the idea of the safe side of the line. I think that's where we don't really think about it, but it is. It does get to a point I suppose the point we've described earlier is really when a line's been crossed, because you can experience so much difficulty without crossing that line. But there will be a point where that line gets crossed, where that is too much. And here's a takeaway I'd love leaders to have, or to take away from this episode, is learn where that line is for you. To me, based on my experience, that's been an important part of understanding how to have that conversation with myself, right? Like you just described. If I don't know where my line is, I won't know what conversation I need to have with myself, or when I need to have it, or how I need to have it, because I just will be kind of blindly going forward, really, and just letting it happen to me. And then, oh, it's too late.
You know? And it's that honesty, it's that self-awareness, it's, you know, taking time to acknowledge how you're feeling instead of keeping suppressing those feelings or, you know, putting those feelings down to, you know, some other cause. But actually having a conversation with somebody else, if you're concerned about somebody else, that should just be a very straightforward, practical conversation.
Really?
And, you know, directly approaching the issue. Sometimes people are afraid to do that for fear that they'll put the idea in their head. When actually all of the evidence-based research tells us that by having the conversation directly, we're actually giving that other person permission psychologically to talk openly about the biggest secret that they've potentially ever carried. Because if I'm confident and direct with you, what that says is, I'm okay with this. You can talk to me. I'm a safe pair of hands, you know?
Yeah, that is a really, really interesting point, because exactly what you just said around we're afraid to have the conversations, I think it's one of the biggest and also worst stigmas around mental health, sorry, around suicide specifically, I should say, is if I say anything about it, I'm going to give them the idea. And actually, if they've already got the idea, then it'll be there regardless of whether you bring it up or not.
Yeah, and you know what, Seven, for some people, just having somebody say, are you having thoughts of suicide? It's a massive relief to be able to think, oh my God, it's okay for me to be thinking like this. You know, it is just another human condition.
Yeah.
So, you know, to say to somebody, look, you know what, mate, I'm a bit worried about you. I've noticed just recently that this and this has been happening. And, you know, that's a factual description of what you've noticed. It's not a label. It's not a diagnosis. It's not you blaming or shaming. You know, for example, I noticed in the meeting this morning you were really distracted. You didn't seem to be yourself. And, you know, now that I come to think of it, over the last few days, I've also noticed this and this. And I'm just wondering, are you all right, mate?
Yeah.
You know, and just going into the conversation in that way and, you know, really listening to what people say to you, because there's a big difference between listening in order to reply and listening in order to understand. And if you're genuinely interested in wanting to help this person, you need to forget your agenda and focus completely on the person in front of you. Not so that you can fix them. And that's the thing, you see, with the suicide intervention training that we do, it's not about you becoming their counselor, their therapist. It's not about you fixing them. It's about you creating an opportunity for that person to be honest with you, to be able to release some of that intensity, because there's just something about when your words meet oxygen. It just makes such a difference to those internal feelings. and it's about creating that opportunity so that somebody can honestly say, well, actually, I am feeling like that right now. This is what's going on for me. But not for you to fix it, not for you to take them home and keep them safe in your spare bedroom, but for you to say, you know, how can I help you get the help you need? And that's what the suicide intervention training is all about. It's not about you becoming, you know, something that you're not. It's about you as a decent human being, recognizing when a fellow human being is struggling and reaching in order to help them get the help they need.
Yeah, I think that's a beautiful place to leave it off. If anything, there's this very straightforward step-by-step process, it might, here's what I would add to that, if I had to add anything, is that that might not be easy to do. You described it as a simple process, and I think it is fairly simple, but not necessarily easy. But for our listeners as leaders, right, this is a kind of conversation that it is difficult to have, but is worth learning how to have if you feel like you struggle to have it.
Absolutely. Sometimes, you know, we just need to put our big girl pants on and go for it.
I love that so much. This has been a really important episode for me because of, I suppose, my own experiences with suicide, as well as my own experiences listening to leaders talk about their struggles. But I think what we've gotten out of it today is this is the kinds of things you need to do and understand within yourself, as well as for the teams, the people, the children, whoever it is in your life that you lead. And the biggest relief for me, in a way, is to know that by making those changes, as simple yet difficult as they can be to make, the knock-on effect of all of that can only make things better. That's the irony, is we think it will make things worse. Actually, it will make things so much better. So I encourage everyone who's listened to this episode to kind of not just to do things like taking notes from it and things like that, but actually to really take on board that sentiment of courage. In a way, you use the word courage, Andrea. I think that's a great way of describing it. So that pretty much brings us to a close. Andrea, thank you so much for joining us. Where can people learn more about you, access you, your website, your online handles, whatever it is? Where can people find more from you?
Okay, my website's nice and easy. It's confidentconversations.co.uk. And I generally tend to hang out more so on LinkedIn. You can normally find me on LinkedIn having a rant or a rage about something or other in my gobby northern bird kind of way. So yeah, LinkedIn or via the website. And also, obviously, as we're talking now in April, it's Stress Awareness Month. If you do have any listeners that would be interested in accessing some resources to help them think about protecting themselves and their teams and their business, if they go to the website confidentconversations.co.uk, there is a fantastic download completely nice. Free of charge to help them sort of think that through. So cool. There's my offer to your folks.
Amazing. I'll put all of that stuff down in whatever descriptions you're listening from today. But that's amazing. I personally am going to actually take you up on that and go and take a look at that. Thank you so much, Andrea, for joining me. And with that, that brings us to a close. So thank you so much, everyone, for tuning in, as always. I hope this gave you some incredible takeaways that you can apply to your journey as a leader and with your own mental health and well-being. Please make sure that you subscribe wherever you're listening to get the next episode as soon as it is released. Lots of love from us, and I will be back here very soon.